to Animal Voices. You're listening to CIUT 89.5 FM, www.ciut.fm. I'm your host, Lauren Corman, here with Sue Teubner and the wonderful Lamia doing teching for us today. Today on Animal Voices, we're going to kick it off with our regular news segment, but in addition to that, we're going to do an interview that sort of was put on hold last week due to unforeseen circumstances. We're going to be interviewing Jennifer Walsh, who is a professor of geography at the University of Southern California. We're going to talk with her about some convergences, some ways that racism and immigration and animal rights collide. We're going to talk about how we can build stronger alliances between the anti-racist movement, civil rights movements, and the animal rights and animal welfare movement. So please stick around for Jennifer Walsh. So Jennifer, I'm so glad you could be here today.
Well, I'm happy to be speaking to you.
Let's just start off the interview maybe with a little bit more background about yourself. You know, I said you're a professor of geography, but maybe you could tell us a little bit more about yourself and how you got started thinking or theorizing about animal issues.
Well, I've always been interested in animals from a very young age and had important relationships with animals as a young person. And I guess I've always been really interested and kind of compelled by the deep-seated contradictions in how people think about and deal with animals. We love them. We spend enormous amounts of money on them. We use them in all kinds of ways. We torture them for various reasons. We wear their skins. And so we have very, very conflicted ideas about different kinds of animals and the animal kingdom in general. So that's something that's always fascinated me. And I also have very strong commitments to the ecological health of the planet, and animals, of course, are central to that health.
So that's what brought you to those issues in particular.
Mm-hmm.
I'm always amazed when we talk to academics who are able to do this type of work, just because it seems like within academia, there's been a little bit of a silence, at least, about thinking about animals or theorizing about animals, or at least having that be taken seriously. How have the people in geography reacted to your work? Is it pretty accepted?
Well, it's very interesting to see how it has been responded to. When I first started doing this work, I thought that it would be seen as definitely kind of fringe and odd and not embraced in any kind of mainstream way. But curiously, it has been very well received. I think a lot of people were struck by a kind of lacuna in geographical research and thought that a focus on animals was long overdue. And so this work has been actually cited quite widely, and it's now anthologized in several places and has become part of the cultural geography literature.
Mm-hmm. I just wanted to give a flag to people who are interested in reading more about some of the things that we're talking about today, and you can maybe give extra references as well, but you collaborated and edited a book called Animal Geographies, Place, Politics, and Identity in the Nature-Culture Borderlands, and so that's what inspired me to contact you to talk about these issues as well. Do you have other references about where people could maybe go and find out more information about the work that you're doing?
Well, there's a chapter by me and Jody Emmel and Chris Wilbert in the Handbook of Cultural Geography, which is a major new cultural geography reference, a couple years old. And there's going to be a chapter forthcoming on attitudes toward marine wildlife in a new Handbook of Feminist Geography. There's a review article in Progress in Human Geography that came out a couple of years ago. So the references are scattered
okay.
About.
Great. So I'm going to ask you probably two really unfair questions.
Mm-hmm.
The first is just about geography. I think that a lot of people, and myself included, until I started really looking at what geography has to offer in terms of thinking through a variety of issues, there's probably some misunderstandings out there about what is covered within the boundaries of geography, which I'm sure there's slippery edges as well. But what does geography have to do with the social sciences, and how does geography contribute to thinking about animal issues or other issues of social justice?
Geography is a fairly old discipline, and you characterize it as a social science, and in many universities it is seen as a social science and in social science faculties. But in fact, it's what we might think of as a bridge discipline, in that there is a whole arm of geography that is quite social in terms of being aligned to social science, but then another part that is really physical science. And here, you know, you can think about geomorphology, climatology, biogeography. These are disciplines that have affinities to the natural and biophysical sciences. Mm-hmm. So, and I think the interesting thing about the field is that, in fact, in one single university department and one discipline, you have both of those kinds of people. And they don't always talk to each other as much as they should, and they mm-hmm. don't always see things the same way, but they are kind of forced to interact with each other and learn more about each other's parts of the discipline than, you know, you would if you were in a regular science or social science department. So it really does span both the human and social sciences, and one of the reasons it does is because a major focus in the field is nature-society relations, the relationship between people and the environment. And, you know, you really can't understand those relations unless you know something about the environment mm-hmm. As well as something about society. Mm-hmm. So that is a major theme in the discipline. And when you think about it, relations between people and animals are a major aspect of nature-society relations. And so it really makes sense for scholars studying human-animal relations, attitudes toward animals, and so forth, to emerge from geography.
Mm. Seems like it shares a lot with environmental studies then, which is the faculty that I'm doing my degree with. People might think in environmental studies, I've had a number of people react to me as if I'm doing environmental science, and they'll say things like, oh, I really like forests too, and are you studying climate change? And that's definitely an element of environmental studies, but there's all this other interdisciplinary work that's right. also social sciences related as well.
That's right, and in geography, there's a subdiscipline called biogeography that has been more scientific in orientation and has mostly looked at plants because for a variety of historical reasons, the work on animal populations was slowly taken over by population ecologists and biogeographers increasingly focused on plants, and the new data sources were also focused on plants, you know, satellite imagery and mapping and so on. Plants don't move like mm-hmm. animals do, and so the richness of information is really better for plants, and of course, you know, plant habitats and plant communities are central to animal populations. But the focus in biogeography has been more on plants, and so one of the things that I wanted to do in kind of introducing or reintroducing this theme of animal geographies was to have a kind of corrective in the field, to have people think more about animals as opposed to plants, and also to think about cultural aspects of the animal world and how people relate to animals.
Mm-hmm. Before we jump into some of those corrective measures, I wanted to ask also another sort of maybe unfair, broad question, just about the relevance of theory to social change. I mean, I have a lot of discussions with activists, and some are very open to the idea of theory being an important part of social change, and that an analysis obviously is important in terms of how we do our activism. But a lot of people, too, you know, you know, you say the word postmodern or discourse or any of those terms, and it's sort of like, no, that's alienating, and it's sort of tangling us up in all these debates. Well, we really need to be going out there and, you know, addressing the fact that animals are being abused or et cetera, you know, various different social justice issues. I'm a theory person. I enjoy theory, and I think it's important as well. But I'm curious about what connection you see between theory and social change.
Well, just think about Peter Singer. He wrote a essentially theoretical book on animals, something of a call to action, but a lot of it was, you know, ethics and philosophy, and it played a huge role in launching the animal rights movement. And other scholarly books have also been very important in bringing new information to the movement and helping the movement see things in different perspectives. You know, think about Carol Adams, for example, and the variety of figures that have been very important. Harriet Ritvo, in terms of getting activists to think through the nature of human-animal relations and how to position themselves within the movement and within society. So I think that theory is really important, and I also think it's important for students to learn and understand. But that doesn't mean that activism isn't crucial, and it also doesn't mean that some forms of theory or some brands of theory may be less activist in orientation than others. I mean, you mentioned postmodernism mm-hmm. and deconstruction and so on. And, I mean, I think there's a general criticism of postmodernism and poststructuralism around the perception that such theory might get us to endlessly analyze signs and symbols and discourse and not do anything.
Mm-hmm.
And there's some truth to that. Mm-hmm. But, you know, that's not the only brand of theory, and, of course, not everybody who is a postmodernist or a poststructuralist or a feminist is a, you know, just sitting in the academy not doing anything. Mm-hmm. So a lot of those people are activists as well. So, you know, I think that there are other branches of theory that are even, you know, more proactive, you know, political ecology, for example. And I think that those theoretical efforts that help us better apprehend how people and animals relate and why are incredibly important. And I'll give you an example. There's a lot of criticism, of course, about various kinds of indigenous interactions with animals, poaching, for example,
mm-hmm.
or, you know, the bush meat trade. But it's really not possible for activists to understand how to intervene or whether to intervene in those kinds of situations without a broader political ecology understanding of why people are engaged in those activities, right? Or else, that, you know, there's a huge risk of making some pretty severe blunders. So I think that theory is pretty important.
Mm-hmm. So it sort of allows us to move forward, but to do it with maybe a bit of a more conscious perception or...
Well, and understand treading. What the root of some of the behaviors are.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think that it's tempting. I think for me anyway, when I was initially looking at animal issues, and I brought, you know, a background of women's studies and to that, but it's, you know, you sort of look at some of the things that happen to animals and different people, and you just start feeling a lot of anger and rage, and you want to do something now, and that type of thing. And I can definitely understand the impetus. Like, we don't need to be sitting around reading books, but, you know, but yeah, I was just curious to hear about some of those connections, because I think that they are important. It seems like one of the things that we'll probably be emphasizing in definitely a latter portion of this interview as well is one of the things that comes strongly across in your perspective and in the writing that you've done is sort of this idea of bridging, you know, how can we have conversations across different types of disciplines and also different movements and different perspectives as well.
Mm-hmm.
So we're going to take a break, and then we're going to come back with Jennifer Walsh to talk more about the connections that she sees between animal issues and racism and immigration. So please stay tuned to Animal Voices. You're listening to CIUT 89.5. Today, we're speaking with Professor of Geography Jennifer Walsh from the University of Southern California. And before the break, we were talking a little bit about connections between activism and theory and between animal issues in the academy and, all, you know, a variety of different topics. But now I'd like to move our discussion into looking at some of the bridges or convergences between animal issues and racism and immigration. And before I had read this essay, Le Pratique Sauvage, Race, Place, and the Human-Animal Divide that Jennifer collaborated on, I really hadn't thought very much about the immigration piece, although there is some information out there, although limited, about connections between race and racism and animal issues and animal rights. Jennifer, can you talk a little bit about some connections then between immigration and how animal issues are taken up in particular way in terms of feeding into racist discourses?
Sure. I think what we were trying to do in this chapter, La Pratique Sauvage, is to highlight the ways in which, under conditions of globalization and transnational migration streams, we're coming to see many metropolitan regions of the world with large immigrant populations, and those populations are coming from parts of the world in which attitudes toward animals and relations between people and animals are quite different. The constellation of animals that people are used to thinking about and interacting with is different. Food is different, which animals are used for food. Norms of treatment and behavior may be different. And yet suddenly people are all living in the same metropolitan region, not always side by side, but in relative proximity, and under a legal system and a system of societal norms that may be quite at odds with the places that the immigrants at least are coming from. And so this is a recipe for conflict between groups, and as I'm sure you're aware, Lauren, many of the cultural attributes that people have or groups of people share are often targeted for mobilization in a racial project designed to racialize people and marginalize people.
Mm-hmm.
And so animal practices of various kinds are amongst those cultural features or behaviors that get targeted.
Can you talk or tell us what you mean by animal practices, just for people who, it's kind of a vague term.
Animal practices is a term that we came up with because there really aren't very many ways of talking about human-animal interactions that capture basically the whole panoply mm-hmm. of experience. So when I talk about animal practices, I really mean the ways in which people treat and use animals of various kinds.
Okay.
And, you know, it can be benevolent ways, it can be not so benevolent ways. And so it's a term that tries to get to the materiality of how people interact with animals.
Mm-hmm. One of the things about this essay that I thought was extremely effective is that there's a number of case studies that are discussed. And I was wondering if you could, either one of those case studies or another example, just to illustrate what you mean by this convergence. This, it says in this chapter that our purpose in attempting to explicate the links between race, place, and animal practices has been to show how deeply ingrained ideas about people and animals have been used to produce cultural difference and devalue subaltern groups. Can you give us a concrete example of what you mean by that?
Sure. One of the most controversial in that group of examples is probably the example around dog eating and killing dogs in the backyard. In one case, there were two men. They were immigrants from Southeast Asia, and they were arrested for, I believe it was, killing a German shepherd puppy in the backyard and mm-hmm. and then cooking it. Well, this, in American society, where the canine, well, thousands and thousands are killed in shelters, but on the other hand, they're part of American families across the country. In this kind of context, killing a dog, much less a puppy, created an enormous amount of controversy. And the people involved, the two men involved, were arrested, and there was a huge amount of press around the incident. And so they were really vilified for this kind of practice, whereas where they come from, this is not atypical behavior. So here you have people who are probably largely bewildered by, you know, norms that they're just kind of figuring out, and their own behaviors, which they grow up with and don't question, they're normalized, right? They seem normal and taken for granted. Suddenly they're called into question. And the controversy in the press around those kinds of incidents lead people to think of folks from that part of the world as, you know, all engaging in those kinds of practices, for example. And just like eating a dog might be normal for someone from some parts of Southeast Asia, similarly, our practices, our own animal practices in the U.S. and Canada, we don't question those either. They're normalized, and they're seen as right and true and appropriate. And so there's this real clash. And then these kinds of practices, as I said, get mobilized in racial discourses around, you know, who's different, whose practices are less humane, and so forth.
Mm-hmm. This becomes a way of saying certain groups of people, too, are uncivilized or savage.
That's
somehow.
Right. That's right. And, you know, we have a very long history of thinking about people and the animal kingdom as a chain of beings, with certain, you know, white male Europeans on the top, and I don't know what exactly would be on the very, very bottom, but you have, you know, women, people of color, foreign people, and then various kinds of animals going on down the chain. And it's a very ingrained way of thinking about the world, even though many people realize if they think about it, they don't really believe that, but it's been around for a very long time. And so devaluing people, putting them closer to animals is a way of, you know, kind of shoving them further down that chain and further from humanity.
Mm-hmm. I think one of the ways this is playing out, too, in the media and the sort of global picture right now is around these various different types of animal diseases. I mean, the press, you know, we have SARS and avian flu now. And, you know, I remember when they killed, it was something like 10,000 civet cats in China, that people in Canada and I'm sure in the United States were really horrified by this. They're killing cats. They had pictures of these animals in cages and things like that. And I think the same thing is happening now, too, with the avian flu, that, for example, a couple of the people that I know, this is the first time that they'd ever seen factory farming conditions, but they were conditions that were coming out of Asian countries. And then, oh my God, I can't believe they do that to chickens, right? And they do that to chickens. And, you know, I was looking up, well, how many birds do we keep in a general factory farm in Canada or in the United States? And it ranges around 20,000 to 30,000. So this is not that weird, right? But it's what is made visible, and how is it made visible in what context? So it seems to be playing out now.
That's right. And I think when there's some kind of Newcastle disease, for example, breaks out in North America, large numbers of birds are killed, right? It's the same response. It's the same quote-unquote solution. But you're right, it acquires this kind of racial tag. One of the big problems that I think we face is how do we condemn animal practices that are really violent and terrible at the same time decoupling that from the people themselves and their cultural setting? And how do we train that same critical eye and that same anger and rage at our own society? Because I think if you look at cultures across the world, we all do really terrible things to animals, and we use animals in ways that are extremely troubling. And it's very important that when we criticize, we subject ourselves to the same kind of level of criticism instead of having the critique come off as something which is, you know, some kind of post-colonial intervention.
How can people come out and say, you know, this practice is harmful to animals, while at the same time not having that be connected with racializing a particular group and discriminating against them? I'm curious what you think. I mean, do people, specifically white Western people, do they have the right to critique these practices happening in other countries, especially when there's so much abuse happening on this continent as well?
I think that one needs to have a lot of caution about this, because I think that it is very... Look at this case in Korea around the soccer World Cup, where some animal rights activists were very vociferous about condemning dog-eating practices and so on, and this led to a huge kerfuffle internationally. I think you have to be very, very careful when you raise those kinds of issues because of this kind of double standard problem. One way to get around it, I think, is for international activists that are concerned about practices in other parts of the world, which we have not only every right to be concerned, but we have the need, there's a big need to be concerned and involved. But it may be very important as a strategy to really work through local organizations. So instead of launching, say, a North American organization's activism at a particular international setting or practice, it might be better to try to either strengthen local groups, help create local groups, but make local organizations that have probably a much better chance of affecting local people's ideas and practices, make them stronger and more effective, and give them the resources that they need in order to change practices from within. And I think if you look at other parts of the environmental movement, you know, there's some other similar kinds of dynamics that go on, right? International environmental organizations marching into developing countries, telling people, you know, how bad they are for deforesting this and that place and so forth, creating a lot of hostility. I think that it's very important for those organizations, and they found it to be important, to actually nurture the local social movements in order to avoid that kind of politicization and actually to create change from within. Because often governments, national governments, they're going to be more responsive to local political pressure than being ganged up on by, you know, international organizations that they're writing off as, you know, kind of neo-colonial powers.
One of the ways that people are racialized in particular ways is through animals, and that race is socially constructed in a variety of different ways, animals being only one way that people are seen as different, etc. I was curious, though, if you could talk a little bit about how animals are socially constructed. This is kind of an interesting idea, and even to say that animals are coded in particular ways, this is some of the language coming out of that text, animal geography. Can you give us some insight about those terms? Socially constructed and coded?
Well, animals are subjects. They have their own lives and minds and desires, but people think about them in particular ways. They have beliefs about them, how they live, why they do the things that they do, what they mean, whether they're linked to witchcraft, so on. So animals are really powerful symbols of good and evil and trickery and passion and so on. And so we project these things onto them. And we also assign roles to animals, right? It's very common to read in the newspaper about, you know, farm animals. Well, I don't think any animal thinks of him or herself as a farm animal, or much less a food animal, which is another kind of role, or a zoo animal. But people code animals in this way, and those codings also have implications for the people who are involved with the animals, right? So squirrels, for example, in the American South in the last century, they were coded as a certain kind of prey, quarry, that only lower class people or African Americans would hunt. Nobody else would hunt them. They were like trash animals. Other kinds of people, elites, more affluent white hunters, would go after the noble creatures of the forest, deer, stag, and so on. So you have animals having their full biophysical and psychological status, materiality, but you also have humans coding them in various ways, giving them meaning, and using them as symbols when they interact with each other.
Mm-hmm.
So that's what that means.
Mm-hmm. So we have, you know, animals are another group that gets coded in addition to humans, and probably the natural world gets coded too in a variety of different ways. We talked a little bit just a few minutes ago about possibilities for how people who are interested in working towards, you know, raising awareness about animal abuse and how they could do that in a culturally sensitive, specific, kind of more local way. I'm curious if you have any thoughts about how to build coalitions across various social justice movements between, for example, the anti-racist movement here and the animal rights or animal welfare movements here as well in terms of a North American context, the United States and Canada in particular.
Well, I think it's a challenge. I think that for a lot of kinds of social movements, they're not used to thinking about animals particularly. And for groups that have been marginalized on the basis of some perceived or ascribed link with animals and savagery, for example, it can be a very sensitive issue.
Mm-hmm.
Right? But I think that we have much to gain from making common cause with other kinds of social movements. And I think that you're seeing that more and more where there's a rapprochement between, for instance, people who are interested in the environment and endangered species and so on, and animal activists, and also within the social justice sphere, more parallels being drawn, more linkages, for example, between social justice and environmental justice, and the rise of thinking about ecological justice and justice for other species. So I think it's starting to happen. It's starting to emerge and be seen in some of the discourse. And I think that we need to work in each other's movements. And so it's important for people to understand where some of the other movements are coming from, be involved in them, and be the bridges to the world of animal activism and animal movements.
Mm. Yeah, because, I mean, the animal rights movement, I think, is largely perceived as, and especially in Canada and the U.S., as being a very white privileged movement. I've even heard of animal rights being called animal whites. Mm-hmm. So there seems to be both a perception as well as, you know, a real gap between the anti-racist movement and the animal rights movement. But at the same time, laying that against the fact that most animal rights activists are coming out of different social justice movements. And, you know, I read some statistics a while ago that was something like 85% of people who come to animal rights activism were doing different types of activism before. I don't know if they continue that as well, but this seems like there's still a lot of potential to work between these movements.
I think you're right. There is a lot of potential.
It's difficult, though, when there's a limited amount of time, try to figure out where you're going to put your energies. But I think that it's an important part of the type of change that we hope to see.
I think you're right. I agree with you.
We only have a couple more minutes left, and I wanted to turn the floor over to you and just wondering if you had any final comments before we end the program.
Well, I think it's great that you're doing this program and that you're raising these kinds of issues. They're sensitive. It's easy to have people misunderstand what is trying to be said and done. Again, just like animal practices are deeply normalized and ingrained, bringing up these issues and talking about questions of racialization in animals and so on, you know, has to be done really carefully, and it doesn't always meet with a lot of acceptance. But I think that talking about it is really crucial, and having people start to think about it and hopefully be introduced to some of the ideas in a non-threatening, non-polarized way is important for people, because ultimately we all have to look at our own practices and what we do on an everyday basis and to be less defensive about that and be willing to be self-critical. And that's always really hard,
mm-hmm.
Particularly if you're part of a group that has been subjected to a lot of marginalization and kind of criticism as a group. So I think forums like this where we can talk about some of these issues frankly and openly, that's a very important thing to be able to do.
Thanks for being on the program, Jennifer.
Well, thanks for inviting me. It's a pleasure to talk to you.
It's a real thrill for me to finally get to interview you. You've definitely been an inspiration to my own work, so really appreciate it.
Well, I'm delighted.
We were talking specifically about an essay. I just wanted to flag this again for people who maybe want to do some more reading. We were speaking specifically about an essay called La Pratique Sauvage, Race, Place, and the Human-Animal Divide. And it's from a book called Animal Geographies, Place, Politics, and the Identity in the Nature-Culture Borderlands. And there's lots of great essays in here in addition to the one we were speaking specifically about today. So definitely encourage people to check it out. As well, Jennifer gave some references earlier on in the hour. If you want any more information about any of those references or questions or ideas for the program or questions you'd like to ask Jennifer, I can forward them on to her. You can write us at animalvoices@ciut.fm. It's animalvoices@ciut.fm. I hope you're able to join us next week on Animal Voices. Thank you to Sue and Lamia for being here today.